that really makes for bad collaboration and coordination.
You're speaking my language. We are back to violent agreement, everybody. So that's a relief.
Well, mummy and daddy were arguing.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast, a show focused on helping you build, run, and invest in Silicon Valley-style startups. Whether you're an investor, founder, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights on the principles that power high-growth disruption the way Facebook, Google, and Uber do it. The conversation starts now.
I'm Yaniv, a software engineer, operator, coach, advisor, investor, and people geek. I've worked at Google in a number of scale-ups and am now co-founder at Circular, a high-growth startup.
I'm Chris. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've been building products, brands, marketplaces, startups, and go-to-market strategies for over 20 years, including 10 years in venture-backed businesses in Silicon Valley. I'm now semi-retired, helping a small handful of startups fast forward to the best high-growth outcomes as quickly as possible.
And our job on this show is to guide you through the unique mindset and approach that drives Silicon Valley-style disruption at scale.
And in this episode, we're going to discuss how to scale your startup, specifically designing your org for growth, product-led growth, the changing role of founders as the org scales, common mistakes in startups and scale-ups, and great execution at the scale-up stage.
Okay, let's jump in. So, carrying on from last episode, we were talking about pre-product market fit. Now, this episode is about saying your startup has reached product market fit, which means that you have a product that people really love to use and keep using to solve a real problem in their lives. Now what? What is the next stage of your startup?
So the next stage is really about taking that early inkling of success and supercharging it. And it's interesting because I find there are a couple of different companies that get to this stage. I think the first type of company are those that have built a product-led business and are really just trying to ramp things up. And the other kind, especially I find in markets outside of Silicon Valley and Australia and Europe and so on, where they've kind of hit some larger inflection point where they're maybe making a lot of revenue, a lot of customers are demanding things, but they really still haven't productized what it is that they've built. And so there's really two courses of action here, depending on the way you've gotten to this slightly larger scaling up stage of your business. And I think we should probably touch on both of those things.
Yeah, I'd like to understand that a bit more. So especially when you talk about the second one, it's not 100% clear to me what you mean by having that product market fit without having productized your business.
Well, a lot of startups are actually trying to scale up, but what they're scaling is the thing we discussed in the very first episode, which is they're scaling a technology-backed services company. Mm. And a lot of quote-unquote scale-ups outside of Silicon Valley are really companies that have sold big, high-touch solutions to large enterprise customers who are now frantically looking around to try to figure out how to make that more repeatable, more scalable, more self-adopt, and more product-led.
Right.
And really many of the scale-ups that I encounter are actually in that phase.
Let's talk about product-led growth. What do we mean by product-led growth? What are other types of growth? And can we sort of contrast them in terms of how they fit into your scale-up?
So these technology-backed services companies, they're typically sales-led. So there is a sales team out in the world, and they're opportunistically trying to close every large account they can get their hands on. Or maybe there's some constraints, but really they're trying to close large accounts, and they're offering often whatever the customer wants to hear or whatever they want to loosely interpret as part of the thing they're doing. They're like, yep, we do that. You have a data problem, we have a data platform. Or you have a marketing problem, we have a Marcom platform. And so we let us sell you that thing. And
yes.
So the sales team sells, you know, broadly speaking, a category of thing. They commit to a series of contractual obligations for what the product needs to do in pretty short order. That gets then thrown over the fence to the product and engineering team, which then have to triage and arbitrage what they build and what's on the roadmap. and the product gets broader and broader and broader, more and more sophisticated, more and more complicated. The business is growing. It's growing really well by all measures of traditional business metrics. The revenue's growing, the number of customers are growing, the brands and logos are growing. These kind of companies love to talk about customer logos, but the thing doesn't scale. As we talked about in the very last episode, how does it reach all the people in the world who have this problem? And the answer is not very easily. Now, that, again, that is sales-led. It is customer support-led. And behind the scenes, there is technology and engineering and product that is frantically trying to keep up. The opposite version of this is what's called a product-led company and product-led growth. This is where the product leads the go-to-market actions and the product managers lead the internal operations. And so product-led really means those two separate things: product-led in market and product-led internally. So let's talk about what that looks like. Product-led in market means that only the very largest accounts, if it's a B2B product, need to talk to the sales team. And they probably need to talk to the sales team after they've already experimented with your product, or some of the departments or individuals in the business have already picked it up and used it. Think of Slack, think of G Suite, think of Atlassian. The sales team is in there to close a larger enterprise deal for something the company's already adopted. They already know it. They already loved it. They've already tried it. The product has sold itself. And this is obviously particularly true in B2C, where the users are just picking it up and using it. So they're buying what you've got rather than the company building what was sold. And the product speaks for itself. And the sales team is maybe closing a larger, more strategic account. Mm. And internally, it is the product team that is leading, meaning they're developing hypotheses, they're developing a roadmap, they're developing a series of things they want to deliver into the world, and they are driving alignment with sales, with support, with engineering, with design, with the executive team around how to support the conception, construction, and delivery of that product into the world. So they are playing an important leadership function rather than playing a more of an arbitrage and project management function. And so those are the distinctions between really a technology-backed services company that is perhaps led by sales and high-touch support, where product management and engineering are acting more like triage nurses, versus a product-led company where the product is speaking for itself and the product management team is driving key strategic decisions and aligning all stakeholders around those.
Okay, that's great. And there's a lot to unpack there, and I've got thoughts and opinions. So first of all, in terms of the definition, I think that's really great. We sort of talk about a technology-backed services business that is led by sales and a genuine software technology company where sales can play a critical but supporting role. And you used one of Henry Ford's two famous quotes in our last episode, but I think both of them actually illustrate this really well. His two most famous quotes are, first of all, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. And the second one is, people can have the Model T in any color as long as it's black. Yes. And so I actually think Henry Ford was a very early product-led growth innovator. In other words, he was saying with both those quotes, first of all, that you don't just build what people ask you to build. And secondly, that you have nearly a kind of benevolent arrogance, right? And that arrogance comes not from you know better, but from exactly what we were talking about in the previous couple of episodes, which is that you have taken the time to understand the market better than any individual participant in that market could hope to. So you know what people need as a collective better than any individual one of them can understand. And in doing so, you can build a business that's incredibly scalable. And then in the case, for example, of the Model T Ford, you're able to pioneer new price points and new efficiencies that have never been seen before. So ultimately, the consumer is the winner, but you do that by not listening, or rather not following their orders. You listen a lot, but you do not do what they ask you to do. You do what they need you to do.
And this is so, so important and so ill understood outside of Silicon Valley. Founders and companies tend to over-index on a particular customer's needs and tend to allow themselves to get drawn into these contractual obligations. And they think of it as being customer obsessed or customer led, and they're very, very proud of it. And what you said is so right. You need to be market obsessed, and you need to be thinking about the very specific personas and problems that your business tackles, and have what I call a healthy disregard for the rest. And you want to ask customers what their pain is, not what features they want. And The other key thing here to know is your customers, your large customers, they're very happy to ask you to solve every problem they've got because no one else is. And so they're going to give you so many asks, and they're going to make each of them feel like life and death. You're going to lose the account if you don't add this to the contract for the next renewal. They feel like they're getting you to do the right thing for them, and you feel like you're doing the right thing by them. But really, you are all engaged in a negative feedback loop that will ultimately kill your company. What you want to do, and what your customers want you to do, even though they don't know it, is they want you to build a world-class product and a world-class business around it, because they want to mitigate vendor risk and they want to have best-of-breed products for their users, their employees, their customers to use. And so I've actually helped a lot of startups and ostensibly scale-ups make this transition away from customer centricity to market centricity to product-led growth and help them essentially do a roadshow to their biggest customers, explaining to those customers why they are no longer going to jump at every command and why their customers should be thrilled about that development. And it's a really counterintuitive thing for these startups and sometimes for these customers to understand. But once you explain it well, they get very excited and very enthusiastic.
That's really interesting. So the other bit that I wanted to address from what you were saying before, and again, this is maybe where the two of us are not 100% aligned. We talk about product-led growth, and I think you conflated it to a certain extent with product manager-led growth. And this is maybe a bit inside baseball, but I think it's a dysfunction that I've seen often enough that is worth unpacking, which is that when you're in a product-led growth mode, it can be common to create some internal turf wars about who's really in charge. And that's typically between product management and marketing. And, you know, that can sometimes get to a point of dysfunction where you actually end up adding a third kind of role and function and type of team, which is the growth team. And that nearly comes as a consequence of the fact that product and marketing aren't able to say, well, we're actually in this together. And if we want product-led growth to be successful, this is a collaboration where there isn't just a function leading, but that true product-led growth integrates product, engineering, design, marketing, customer support. And we need to all do this together to understand our customer needs, to understand the market, and then to get people to understand the value that we offer, and then actually offer that value, right? So I would like to, in a moment, kind of break down the traditional kind of difference between like product and growth marketing. But to me, it's just so important that you break down the silos here and say, well, true effective growth at the scale-up stage is a massively cross-functional endeavor.
You're actually touching on the next big mistake that I see a lot of scale-ups, and I'm using scale-ups in kind of quote marks, do outside of Silicon Valley, which is to design their org really, really poorly and add a lot of job titles out of big companies and out of agencies that are the wrong functions, the wrong titles, which diffuse accountability and responsibility and confuse lines of communication. So let's perhaps talk about some of that a little bit. And this is maybe where we have a disagreement, which is exciting. We should tease this out. So when I say product-led growth, you use the word conflate. I have connected those two things together, which is to say it's product-led in the market and it's product-led as a function. And I think those two things are connected. And I think that an effective and functional role of a product manager or senior product leadership at a company is to actually act as the coordinator between all of these functions. I think most people think of product managers as the messengers from the business to engineering and taking business requirements and turning them into technical requirements. And that's why in some cases they'll even hire, and this is the first role that I think is a disaster, they'll hire business analysts to analyze business requirements and write them into technical requirements. The role of a product manager is to take the business priorities, to develop a principled, opinionated view of the world, of a product strategy, and to work with all craftspeople in the business in order to execute that product strategy. And so that might mean collecting data from all of the functions, marketing, sales, support, leadership, engineering, and so on, to synthesize or triangulate a roadmap based on those insights, and then to drive alignment and consensus around that roadmap, and then to work with all of those stakeholders in order to execute that roadmap, which might involve writing requirements, coordinating and collaborating with design to refine and flesh out those requirements, coordinating, collaborating with engineering to flesh out and require those requirements and to execute them, to work with marketing, to understand what the marketing implications are, and so on and so forth. And so it absolutely is a collaboration, but I think a collaboration that needs to be coordinated by product.
Okay. So 90% aligned with you. Here's a thing where it's maybe worth unpacking. And this is, you know, if you look at the new field, which awkwardly called growth or growth hacking or growth marketing, you know, not the terminology I would have chosen, but the way that that field distinguishes itself from product management is they look at through the lens of customer value. And I think it is an interesting lens. And so I think it's kind of worth having this discussion. Where the idea, because, you know, I think one thing that we completely agree on is that the role of the product manager is as someone who understands the customer, who understands the market, understands how to bring value, who works with stakeholders, especially engineering and design, to bring that value to life. Now, what growth marketers would say is there is the value itself, which is when a customer is onboarded to the product and using the product, how valuable is it for them? And that is the product value. But then there's the question of how do we make it possible for as many people as possible to actually experience that value and therefore become customers? So in other words, it's nearly the field of dreams thing, right? It's sort of like, okay, you can create an amazing product that is incredible to use. Now, how do you make sure that everyone gets far enough in that they experience that value and stick around because they see that it's great for them? And that's where the growth marketer, the sort of the full stack marketer who sees their job as much more than just acquisition, comes in. And I think that is a valid perspective. And I think there is this thing when product management feel like they are the kind of, I've often used the term first among equals, right? So the sort of, they're not more important than everyone else, but they kind of have this leadership role, which I agree with. But if that's siloed off from marketing and marketing is seen as this kind of, let's put lipstick on the pig after, you know, after we've already finished building it, then you're missing a huge opportunity to turbocharge your growth.
So I definitely think that focusing on acquiring and converting users into that value is a distinct operation, a distinct mindset, and a distinct process. Where I would clarify, though, is I don't think that's a marketing function. I think that product managers should all have a growth mindset and should all be creating hooks and opportunities in the product to reach out and acquire users, whether it's sharing features or multiplayer features or collaboration features or an incredible onboarding funnel, cold start experiences. I think converting users to value is the first role of product and product management. And so what I would be looking for is a growth-minded product manager who might be focused on a mission around onboarding or a mission around customer acquisition pathways, or focused on multiplayer or focused on social features. But my hesitation is in classifying and placing that. In my mind, marketing owns channels, they own brand, they own campaigns, but they don't own evergreen product pathways or product user experiences. And I don't think that they're well suited to own that. And so to the degree that these are permanent baked in pathways into the product, then the product org and by extension, all the craftspeople in it, you know, the design, engineering, and so on, really should own that and should have that top of mind. There's also a function here that's missing, which we should talk about. It's just product marketing, which is a hybrid role that creates a bridge. And so product marketing sits inside product teams and helps the product manager and the team think about marketing and the market and thinks about how to communicate key product messages out to the market using the marketing channels that the marketing team have set up. And then vice versa, bringing market insights back into the product team from marketing and from the market. And so there is that bridge there, and there is certainly a deep collaboration with the marketing team. But I would want in my scale up for product to feel a deep sense of ownership about growth and particularly, as I said, product led growth.
Yeah, and this is interesting. And I think we're deep in the murk here now. And this is good because we talked about organizational challenges within scale-ups. And this is exactly the sort of thing that if it doesn't get thought put into it, it all goes pear-shaped, right? And, you know, you mentioned product marketing. You also see job titles such as growth marketer or growth product manager and various other things like that. We've got many companies that have a head of growth or a VP of growth. I've even seen chief growth officer. So there are a lot of different titles and ways of viewing these things out there. And I guess, you know, one way of resolving our disagreement here, Chris, is to say, well, there's more than one way to skin a cat. But, and this is the important thing here, is it actually, there is a lot of thought that needs to go into designing your organization. And I think the biggest thing that goes wrong is not having that thought about how you create an organization that is truly collaborative and cross-functional. So we talk about siloing and, you know, each function sort of owning its own turf. And that's I think, the biggest dysfunction of all. If I may quickly plug, I mean, my other content life here is I actually have a newsletter blog called People Engineering. And I mentioned in the intro, I'm a people geek. Scale-ups are actually where I've spent a lot of my time thinking about how you build effective organizations. And, you know, regardless of exactly how you maybe divide up product management versus growth versus marketing, you know, I absolutely, as an aside, Chris, I absolutely agree with you that traditional marketing is perhaps not well placed to own this sort of full stack growth. But what we have seen lately is emerging is a different type of marketing, a different discipline of marketing that actually is a much more product oriented. And maybe in the end, it just comes down to definitions. Like, do you still consider that marketing or not? But anyway, the point is organizational design is one of the big things that happens when you go from startup to scale up. Now, why is that? It's because when you go to scale up, there's two types of scaling that you're doing, right? You're scaling up growth. But in order to do that, generally what you've done, you've reached product market fit, you've raised a Series A round, you've got a lot of money, You're going to use that money to hire people, and you need to hire people because there's a lot that needs to be done to get to that effective growth. And so you kind of go from that, oh, okay, you know, we're 10, 20 people to over a couple of years, you ramp up to 100 people. And suddenly you're not a team anymore. You're an organization. An organization has a much more complex structure. And in particular, an organization is something where if you don't really thoughtfully design it, then massive inefficiencies come up. And that's where you get your typical organization that's full of silos, full of politics, full of misalignment. And if you're able to get your scale up to not fall victim to that, then you're ahead of 95%+ of other scale ups.
Yeah. And I think the key patterns that we'll both agree on at a high level is you want to be careful about underinvesting in the team. So you'll see often scale ups that don't have enough product managers for the number of engineers and the number of teams they have. You'll see them having lack of seniority in engineering management. You will see them have a total lack of understanding about what product marketing is. So there'll be an underinvestment in the functions and in the people in those functions. And sometimes you'll see the opposite. You'll see an overinvestment where they're adding more and more roles and job titles in order to compensate for weaknesses in the maturity of their team. So you'll start seeing them hiring, you know, BAs, business analysts, and product owners, and just like all of these other titles where what they really need is just a lean team with accountability and full stack ownership. And I think it doesn't really serve us here to go through all of those roles and things. There's other materials, and I'll put a plug in for my own website where I've written some of this content down about what the roles are and what their responsibilities are. But you want to definitely be careful about underinvesting in the team or over indexing on more and more titles to make up for the weaknesses in the maturity in the team. And the last thing I'll say to pick up from where you left off is you do not want to put these people in functional silos. So you don't want the marketing team over there and the design team over there and the engineering team over there and the product team over there. What you want to do is you want to create cross-functional squads. At Uber, what we used to call cross-functional program teams. They're sometimes called product teams, although it's a bit confusing because it biases towards product. Sometimes they're called delivery teams, which I don't love. No. But the point is, these are atomic units within the business that have a representative from each function, all working together in order to execute a long-lived mission. So let me give you an example. I'm going to call them squads for this conversation. A good squad, a good cross-functional squad, is not one that is stood up to solve a short-term tactical problem like, oh, we really need to get the mobile app out, or we need to really put out this fire. So you guys get together in a room and solve that and then come back to us and we'll put you on something else. No, a long-lived cross-functional team needs to have a long-lived mission. So your mission might be to solve for discovery in the product, or to solve for social features, or to solve for onboarding, or to solve for some aspect of the product that will be there for 12, 24, 48, infinity months, and that you want to work on as part of that team. And it should be made up of individuals from every function: engineering, product design, product marketing, in some cases, data science, and so on. And those people work together in the same, if you would think of an office layout, they're in the same area. They're sitting next to each other. They are working on the same piece of work for that sustained period of time, and they're accountable to each other. And that is very, very different than having a layout in an office, for example, where the design team's over there and the product team's over there and the engineering team's on a different floor. That really makes for bad collaboration and coordination.
You're speaking my language. We are back to violent agreement, everybody. So that's a relief.
Well, mummy and daddy were arguing.
This is actually at the core. When I see myself as an organizational leader, getting this to happen, I see as being at the absolute core of the leader's job, right? In a technology and a product-led company, to have these squads, and you use the term atomic unit, which is great because that's exactly the term that I like to use as well. It's indivisible. And what is atomic about it is the accountability rests with the squad, not with any individual function within the squad, right? You fail together or you succeed together. And that means you have to hold each other accountable and you have to be held accountable as a collective. That's really important. Now, there's a few things there to sort of unpack that. So I can share some of my earlier thinking. Some of this comes back to my time as chief operating officer at Airtasker. So if anyone from Airtasker is listening to this, this should be familiar. So one of the things is, in the industry, there's sometimes this terminology of the triad, or sometimes called the stool. And that comes from the idea that there are these three key functions. There's product management, there's product design, and there's software engineering. And your leadership is effectively of a squad is effectively composed of the product manager, the product designer, and the engineering lead. I think that's a really good concept, but you actually covered this, Chris. It's not always three. And I think if we're going to be flexible and not be like super focused on your very classic product team, you will often see functions like data analysts, marketers, and sometimes others as well in there. And sometimes you'll have functions missing as well. Sometimes you have a growth team that won't have any engineers. So at Airtasker, we actually coined the term the Hydra, and you know, the slightly cheesy slogan of many heads, but one heart, right? So the idea there is within your team, you have a lot of different perspectives, but ultimately you've got this sort of one beating heart and you're either all alive together or you're all dead together. So that's really important in terms of that atomic unit. And the final thing I just wanted to address, we touched on a little bit earlier, is the slightly unique role of the product manager. I am, and this is one of my slightly controversial views, because not in the sense that not everyone shares it. I talked a lot about joint accountability. The alternative to that is, oh, the product manager is kind of the leader. You hear the product manager as the CEO of the squad, who's ultimately accountable. I don't agree with that. I think it takes too much agency away from the other functions. But I do think the product manager has a bit of a special leadership role. And I use the phrase first among equals to describe that. So they're not, nobody reports to the product manager, right? So I think that's your hint that they're not the CEO. but they do have this role of kind of leading from the front within the product team and making sure that overall that squad is able to be successful.
What you described there makes a ton of sense. And there's something you touched on, which is worth unpacking, which I think is non-obvious in most companies, which is this idea that these people are in a squad together, but they don't report to each other. And that's really, really important. So there's actually two organizational structures going on at the same time. There are reporting lines. I don't know what the technical terms are for these, but there's kind of like the functional org chart. And then there is the operational org chart. And those are two slightly different things. So let's talk about that. Within the squad, we've talked about there's engineers, there's designers, there's product management. In some cases, there's data science. As you said, it depends on the org and the function. For example, at Uber, we had a thing called Prod Ops, which is a product ops. So they were the bridge between the product team and the operations team, because Uber was a kind of ops tech hybrid. And so you make up that squad how you need to make it up. And the individuals in that squad are accountable to each other. They share one beating heart, to use your metaphor. I love that very much. And so they're all working on the same piece of work together, the same mission. They live and die together, to use your metaphor again. They have the same OKRs. They have the same roadmap, and they collaborate and coordinate to build those things. Maybe the product manager is half a step ahead to provide some coordination and guidance on these things. But the people they report to are totally different. The engineers report to the engineering manager in that squad. And the engineering manager reports to the group engineering manager, who reports to maybe the director of engineering, reports to the CTO. Maybe there's a couple of product managers on the team because there's someone learning. So let's say there's an associate product manager. They would report to the product manager, who would report to the group product manager, who would report eventually up and through the chain to the chief product officer. The designer or designers on the team would report to the group design lead and up through to the head of design. And so the people in your org are reporting to other people in the same function, in the same craft as them, so that when there comes time to career advice, to coaching around the craft, to performance reviews. They are being given insights by people who understand their work, understand their craft, understand the challenges and the pros and cons of that life, of that work, and of that career.
Couldn't agree more. Is this, by the way, this is sometimes called the Spotify model, which is completely inaccurate in multiple levels, including that it did not originate at Spotify. And even Spotify says you shouldn't call it that. But I would just mention it because it's still a fairly common bit of terminology.
Mm.
But there is actually a nuance here as well, which is, let's say you're an engineer on the discovery team. If I asked you, what team are you on? Who's your team? In a well-running scale-up, you should say, I'm on the discovery team, right? If you say, I'm in engineering, then things aren't quite right. And so what I mean by that is it's a matter of identity. Like, yeah, who do you share your heart with, right? Where does your attention go day to day, hour to hour? What matters to you? You're an engineer, so of course you should care about the quality of the code, the architecture, the design patterns, and so on. But what you care about, what you need to care about, is how do I make the discovery squad succeed? And, yes, you know, that's one of the things I saw when I first joined Airtasker, actually, is we had this model notionally, and we were even calling it the Spotify model of cross-functional teams. But when you asked an engineer, you know, what's your team? They would say engineering every time. And so I had to kind of invert that and say, no, sure, your manager is an engineer, but that is not, those are not the most important relationships in your work life. The most important relationships are with the other people in your cross-functional squad.
I really, really resonate with that. And that's exactly right. This is also what we did at Uber, which was borrowed in from Amazon and from Google and from other leading companies in the Valley. But what this brings up to me is actually the next topic, which is the role of the founders and leaders as the org scales. And you just touched on a piece of that. And so let me kind of riff off that. The leaders of the squad, and I'm referring, you know, you talked about the three legs of the stool. I'm referring to the senior people on the squad, the engineering manager, the product manager, perhaps the senior designer. It is their job to create that kind of culture, to do lunches and dinners. And at Uber and the Uber developer platform team, we made sweatshirts and swag and stickers. And that was particularly important for us because we were building a kind of outward facing brand even for that squad. And it's your job as the leaders, as the senior people in a squad, to create that squad culture. And that's particularly important between the engineering manager and the product manager, right? There's often, not always, but often a healthy tension between engineering and product. And that tension, that healthy tension should exist because engineering has real technical constraints and considerations, and product is always asking for a little more than they can and should get. And
yeah, I actually call that creative tension. And I deeply agree with you. It's actually right, where the magic happens.
It's important though for those two people to maintain a healthy, or I would say an enthusiastic respect for each other, to maintain that culture within the team. But then I want to go a bit broader. That's the role of leadership within a squad. But then when you have these individual squads with these individual missions, with individual sweatshirts, you know, cheering on their squad, you risk balkanization, you risk silos within these squads. And so what is equally important is that the functional leaders, the group product manager, the group engineering manager, the group design leader, the head of design, the head of engineering, the head of product, for them to create cross squad culture for their function. There's a wide range of tools and we're not going to discuss them all, but that might look like anything from fortnightly or monthly all hands for that function. It might look like a lunch and learns where those functional members can come and learn from each other about what their various squads are doing. It might look like function specific cultural values about how they make decisions about design or engineering. It might look like principles of design or engineering or product. It might look like running code. It might be base classes or bootstrap style design patterns and design libraries. It's whatever the leaders can do to create a shared sense of community across the entire function in the business, even while those people, their heart and their passion is within their squad. And so that way you get a kind of a lattice or a matrix of responsibility to the squad and to the business, to the squad and to the function.
Yeah, you said that very well. There's not that much I can add to it. But what I would say is, in terms of, especially you mentioned there, the senior leaders and the founders, there's a very significant change in role that happens from being a startup to being a scale up. And you're effectively moving from being in a very executional, operational role to being, for want of a better term, an executive. And what I mean by that is, you are now in a role where you're doing two things. You are making a small number of really important decisions around strategy, and then it is your job to enable your organization. And enabling your organization looks like being really good at communicating and getting alignment about setting culture. And I think a lot of what you're talking about is in a sense culture setting. It's like, this is how we do things here. This is what we care about, and motivating people. And if you stay too hands-on, it starts to become deleterious, right? Because, you know, I think the CEO who comes in and interferes with the team's roadmap is nearly a cliche, because it happens all over the place, right? And it's not helpful. So what you need to be doing as you pivot, even in the same title, you know, you were the CEO of the startup, now you're the CEO of the scale-up, or whatever the role is, CTO, head of product, whatever it is. Your job now is to enable your team. It is no longer to be the best at doing stuff or to tell people what to do. And that's a really big transition. And I think when you look at the mistakes that companies make, or the failures of companies that go to the scale-up stage, it is often a failure of the founders and the early leadership team to make what is a very significant and challenging role transition, even as they maintain the same job title. So it can be, sometimes people don't even realize that they're supposed to go through a role transition, but nonetheless, it's critical.
Yeah, I was actually speaking to a founder that I work with at a scale up, and I was saying, you know, as you start to get to second and third and fourth degree of separation from people you directly hired to now they're hiring people and they're hiring people, you know, you start to go from being a person to being the founder. You start to develop an aura around you that you're like special, and you created this thing and your word is gospel. And I actually said to him, you'll notice people start to straighten their back a little bit as you walk through the hall. You know, they will just pay that little bit more attention to what you're saying. And a casual word from you, a casual curiosity, can send people off in random directions trying to meet your expectations or your whim. And so you have to be really, really careful. And as you were very eloquently stated, you know, you're used to, in a small startup, just getting shit done and things moving really fast. But you need to move from building the thing to building the thing that builds the thing. So you're building the org instead of building the product. So as you said, that requires you to focus on vision, on culture, on business priorities at the quarterly or half level. And that does not mean, you know, every feature you want to ship, but the markets you want to break into, or the regulatory risk you need to dial down, or what are the big business changes and bets that you need to make that quarter, and formulate it in a very actionable way, likely in OKRs. And you want to focus on funding, getting funding for the company, which is fundraising, but also assigning funding to squads or groups that are meeting the priorities of the business. So these are the levers you have as a founder. It's no longer diving into the code or diving into the design or picking up a random superstar engineer and bashing something out over the weekend. It's about creating a space for everybody to do their best work and understand what direction they need to go and what trade-offs they need to make.
Yep, absolutely. So, wow, each episode seems to get longer than the one before. I wonder if you have an example of what you see as great execution at the scale-up stage, if there's a company you could use as an example, or, you know, just a sort of something that you've seen that you wanted to share.
There's probably a lot of great examples. The one that I've seen most closely and most passionate about is what Uber did at around, 2,000 to 15,000-17,000 employees, right? Around a year, 3, 4, 5. I really feel like that was a breathtaking exercise in decentralized authority and accountability. Mm. And execution at speed and at scale. Now, there were a number of serious critical mistakes. Of course, there was an underinvestment in culture. There was an underinvestment in HR. There was an underinvestment in certain nuances that needed to be expressly made. But in terms of the actual ability to delegate responsibility to the edges, inspire effective execution, hire amazing people, and have them, with really some degree of coordination, build and deliver value to market, I think it was really one of the greatest examples in the history of the world. And it was really using the model that we've been describing. It was about hiring excellent people, making them the CEO of their thing, giving them a mission that they deeply believed in their bones, that they were responsible for, and it was life and death for the business. And helping them to then, in a recursive way, delegate pieces of that mission to yet smaller, granular teams, and holding those teams to a really high account and having them execute to a really high level of effectiveness. And then the last piece of detail that we haven't really touched on, but worth mentioning, is having a clear path of execution when people are blocked. So that the last thing we should probably touch on is, when you have these silos, each with their own silo level leaders, and you have these groups of silos with each of their group level leaders, invariably there will be collisions, and collisions are okay. What we're talking about is optimizing for speed, not optimizing for deduping of effort, right?
Yep.
And what you want to do is you want to encourage the org to escalate.
And this is
really important, right? And to not think of escalation. So escalation is really going to your boss and asking for help, right? Escalation is not like telling mummy and daddy on your colleague, right? It is about recognizing that two people on the same tier don't have enough visibility, perhaps, to decide on a particular trade-off. And so they need to, perhaps the eng manager and the product manager, or two product managers in two different squads, they need to escalate to their group product manager or eng manager and ask them to help resolve a trade-off that was not clear at the lower level. And if that resolution is not easy to make, then those group product managers or eng managers or what have you can escalate further up the chain. And this is a healthy kind of dispute resolution tactic that helps unblock things and holds people to account and makes decisions quickly. It's something I didn't understand when I first went into a bigger scale up like Uber, because I felt like, oh no, I should be able to solve everything by myself and I shouldn't have to rely on other people. And really, actually, Travis himself, the CEO of Uber and co-founder, said to me, no, dude, that's what the org is there for. You need to escalate and to resolve these tensions using the structure of the org.
I'm going to do something slightly obnoxious right now and quote myself. So I mentioned I have my newsletter, People Engineering. I actually just published an article yesterday about what it means to really have a sense of ownership. And one of the things I wrote about was that inclination to escalate. So what I wrote there was, teams that are driven to deliver value do not tolerate obstacles that stand in the way of doing so. Those that they can remove themselves, they remove themselves. Other obstacles are escalated to their leaders for swift resolution. Teams with a sense of ownership see it as their duty to bring those obstacles to the attention of those who can remove them. They understand that otherwise they are not doing their jobs. So it's really core, right? Not only is it like not telling on your colleagues to escalate this thing. If you sit on an obstacle and don't bring it to the attention of someone who can do something about it, then you're failing at your job. And so really you need to create a culture of safety so that people feel comfortable escalating.
And if you're a leader who has things escalated to you and you delegate back down or you fail to resolve the escalation, you're a bad leader. And you yourself may need to escalate it up.
Yeah.
The essential role of leadership is to create this shared culture and to create shared principles, shared spaces for success, and ultimately to resolve ambiguities around trade-offs. either in a one-off fashion or by adding more context to the principles, patterns, ways of working, and priorities.
Yeah, I feel like we should have like a segment on like bad management advice. I think another bit of bad management advice I see far too often is when, you know, managers say, oh, you should tell your people, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. I'm like, that is fucking ridiculous.
Yes.
That is how you create a chilling effect. That is how people don't escalate things to you because they don't want to be yelled at for coming to you with a problem and not a solution. If there is a problem as a leader, if there is a problem somewhere in your organization, it should be your first priority to know about it. And
that's
it
right.
is often your job to come up with a solution.
All right. Well, we have gone way over time here. So let's wrap things up. As you'll know, we've discussed what does it look like to design your org for growth? What does product-led growth mean? And we had a little bit of healthy debate about that, which is awesome. The changing role of founders and, in fact, leaders of all kinds across the org. And some great examples out of Uber and some breathtaking mistakes out of the old playbooks of leadership. So, you know, I think on subsequent episodes, we're going to start talking about other forms of execution. What roles do founders play? What roles does venture capital play? How do you manage risk and so on? So stay tuned for that. As Yaniv, you always say, and I'll take the opportunity to say it this time, please make sure you subscribe, rate, share. It kind of soothes our fragile egos, but it's also feeds the algorithm and helps push this out there. And frankly, it motivates us to keep going as we see the stats tick up. Please leave a comment wherever you found this recording, whether it's LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Tell us what you thought of the topic, where do you agree or disagree with us, and maybe what you want to see us cover next.
Cracking episode, Chris. Thanks so much.
This was awesome. We'll catch up next time.
All right. See ya.